Hello, 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 listeners, and welcome back to Northern Nightmares.
Hello.
Oh, my voice is a little bit shaky today, but at least it sounds better. It sounds a little less nasally.
Every day, we're getting better.
Getting there. We are so glad to have you here. And unfortunately, we have a little bit of a sad announcement to make.
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, our announcement today is going to be a little bit twofold. For the first part, we are going to have to take a break for the month of December. Quentin and I are going on a cruise, so we're going to be out of the country for a short period and then traveling around the lower 48 for a couple of additional weeks so that we can visit family and spend some time with family around the holidays. And with that, there's just no time for Mom and I to record or schedule recordings that work for both of our time zones and her work schedule. Along with the fact that I really don't want to be working on vacation. So we're going to have to take off the month of December. In addition to that, we will be back in January. And then by the end of February-ish, possibly early March, it's going to kind of depend on the episode schedules and how the next couple of months play out. Northern Nightmares is going to have to go on an indefinite hiatus. And the reason for that is just because I am currently a grad student. Quentin and I are in the process of buying a house. We're getting a new puppy. We're trying to have a kid. And everything is just a lot. I'm finding that I really don't have time for the podcast and family. And family just really needs to come first right now. My family and my career are probably the most important things in my life. And unfortunately, I do not have the time or the resources to continue to do the podcast in the way that I would like to see it done. So therefore, I'm really hoping this podcast is something that can continue in the future. But for the time being, once we get back, we're going to do some big, hard-hitting episodes that we've always wanted to do. We're going to cover Robert Hansen, Gary Zegler, the Thunderbird Falls case, which don't look that up because I'm really excited to talk about it. But anyway, we will be continuing to produce content in January and for February, but it is coming that Northern Nightmares will have to go on hiatus, and we will keep you appraised of that situation as it unfolds and when that date is coming. So just keep an ear out and continue to listen. We love each and every one of you, and we really hope that you will continue to listen to these last couple of episodes and enjoy these last few episodes with us, as we have so greatly enjoyed this process of recording with you all. So next week, which is, I believe, the first Monday in December, I think it's December 5th, we're going to have a little bit different of an episode. Mom and I are going to do a year review, and we're going to talk briefly about the cases that most greatly impacted us. And then we'll be back to regular scheduled content in January, which is when I can pick up with the research side of things. So we thank you so much for your understanding and your continued support. Just by listening to this podcast, you help us continue to do what we're doing. So we are ever so grateful for you. Thank you.
We will drop in occasionally, so keep your subscription up. We're going to keep it so that you can still find our podcast. You can still get updates when we do updates, because there's a lot of things that we've covered that haven't even gone to trial yet. So when we hear of those things, we'll definitely keep you updated on those things. We don't know when we might come back. It's an awful lot on Heather. She has a lot on her plate. And
yeah.
We just need to, something needs to give. It's to the point where she doesn't have time for Heather. She doesn't have time for her husband. So, this was I wouldn't say the easiest to give up, but it does take a lot of her time.
Right. And currently, I mean, our numbers have been dropping, or our listeners have been dropping.
Not that we don't appreciate every single one of you that's listening right now.
We do, which is why it's so hard when we've had a lot of drop-off lately. And I know that a huge part of that is just that I wasn't able to keep up with the social media, which is just what happens when a person is overworked and just can't seem to get on top of it, because I'm already so far behind. So the TikToks have stopped, and it's been a little bit messy, and we don't want to do the podcast messy.
Or half-assed, you know? Or
We want to be able to do this right. And right now, I mean, we're already on the border of not quite doing it as well as we want to be able to do it. Me specifically, I want to be on top of the TikToks. I want to be on top of the social media. And that's just not where I'm at right now.
And we thought we'd be enlisting more help. And it's hard to do.
Yeah,
it's hard to do. And our people that we were trying to enlist are working as well.
We're learning a lot as we go through this podcast, and I definitely don't want to say that it's over, because it's not.
It's not over.
A lot of really big cases that we're covering before we go on hiatus. But right. I just want to let you know that come like the next semester, I can't do it right now. So we're going to wait until a point where I'm a little bit more steady and able to pick this back up. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we hope you keep listening. Each and every one of you just means so very much to us.
And still spread the word, because the podcast will still be found. And there's going to be 52 or so-ish episodes, 55 episodes right. or something by the time we're done. Because we wanted to do the full year, because we mm-hmm. started in January yes. last year. So we wanted to make sure we finished out and did a full year. So that would be 52. But we are actually going to have more episodes than that,
I think. A little bit more, yeah. Because there's a few cases really wanted to cover.
Yep, that we do not want to leave in the wind. So the last cases that we're going to be doing are they're all big cases. They're all things that you've probably heard about. Mm-hmm. So we love you all, and we thank you, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us up to this point.
And this has nothing to do with any of you guys at all.
This is just, this is a break. It's not a goodbye.
Yes. It's a see you later.
Yeah, but sure. Keep listening. We still have 10 more really good episodes.
Yes, so, yes.
Or thereabouts. Yes. So keep listening.
Yep. And to our measly number of patrons, we love each and every one of you. We're sending out a special little gift for the holidays. And in the meantime, just be sure that come February, your Patreon subscription is no longer active. We don't want you to have to be paying for content that we're no longer releasing. So,
but the Patreon content will still be available. Oh, yeah. If somebody wanted to pay $5 and binge everything that we have on Patreon,
yeah,
they could.
But yeah, there will be no new Alaskana. There will be no new bonus episodes being released there after January's mm-hmm. episodes. So just keep that in mind. It's with sorrow hearts that we share this with you guys. It's like we said, it's just gotten to a point and a different stage in life, and things change. So.
And we didn't know where we'd be a year ago, mm-hmm. When we started. So. Right. I'm proud of our podcast. I love our podcast. I think we have really good content. Mm-hmm. Heather's done an excellent job researching each and every episode.
Thanks, Mom.
It's been a whole family affair, too. It's not just us. I mean, our right. spouses, our my kids, they all, they're involved, right? So it's just too much at this mm-hmm. point.
Mm-hmm. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, do you have anything positive to share about your week?
I thought we would.
We gotta bring it up like maybe a little bit, because the case is so big, so bad.
I didn't know you wanted something positive. Well, this airs after Thanksgiving, so hopefully everybody's fat, happy, and sassy, and got their Christmas shopping done.
Hopefully we'll just plan on having a really, really great Thanksgiving. I think that Mom and I have been really stressed this week. It's been a little bit rough for us up here, and everything's dark now. That's been hard. The shift, we talked about in the springtime when it shifted and we felt like we were on crack or something.
Right.
Because, oh my God, sunshine and energy.
Now we're on Ambien.
Yeah. Now it's a little.
We had just enough. Tired. Just enough snow to freeze. Mm-hmm. So now the snow is ice, and it's supposed to be just clear, clear, clear skies and cold, cold, cold for the next 10 days.
Right. I mean, right now it is 6:03 p.m. on November 18th, and it's pitch black outside.
And it's been pitch black.
Yeah, it's been pitch black since 5. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We went to the Vintage Market today.
That was a lot of fun in Palmer. That was positive. Palmer, one of our favorite places we talk about frequently.
Yes. All of the local little shops and artists come out and you just get to shop for your Christmas presents all in one place. And it's just very convenient. And it's really cool to see all the local wares. And so that was really fun. And it was a really good time with Mom and Megan. That was fun.
It was a good girl's day. I've had a very girly day. I had my hair done this morning and then I went to the Fern and had coffee with one of my friends and her daughter, little daughter, who's like 2 years old. Then we went to lunch at the brewery and then we went to the Vintage Market. It's just been a very girly, fun day.
You are living your best life.
It was a good day.
That is for sure.
Yes.
With all that being said, let's talk some murder with my mom.
Let's do it.
All right, everybody. Today we are going to be talking about the Newman family, which is a very well-known case that happened here in the 80s. And it is specifically well-known and remembered to this day because of how brutal and graphic the crime was. The case does include some really horrific details about sexual assault and sexual violence, specifically against young children. So, massive trigger warning up front. This is the first case, I think, where I actually was crying while typing up my notes.
And not able to sleep after you got them done.
Right. It was, this was
really affected you.
Really tough. So please, please, please take care of yourself. And if you are sensitive to subject matter around the murder of children or around sexual assault, period, this episode is definitely not for you. There's also not just bits and pieces that are going to be graphic. Unfortunately, the parts that will be hard to hear are sort of scattered throughout the episode, so it's not easy to skip around as it is with some of our other cases. So just keep that in mind as you listen, and please take care if you continue on. All right, so let's just dive in. Our case today takes place on Ide Street in Anchorage, Alaska in 1987. Ide Street gets kind of cut in half by Benson Boulevard in Midtown Anchorage. So you take Anchorage is basically a big circle, pretty much, or rectangle. Midtown is obviously in the middle of that. And that's kind of where we're talking about today. If you are familiar with Anchorage, because I know a lot of our listeners are from Alaska, we're talking about the area sort of by the Midtown Walmart and Barnes & Noble.
Which, I don't know how it was in the 80s, but now that is not the premier place part to of be. Town. It's a lot of homeless in that area, a lot of drugs, a lot of crime. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it definitely wasn't great in 1987 either. I mean, this is coming off of the 70s with the oil boom, and we've talked about the crime area,
right. The
crime in Anchorage a lot. The 80s were only very marginally better than the 70s. So it wasn't the best time to live in Anchorage. I mean, but
small police force, large booming population.
Right.
A lot of roughneck men up on the slope. Not that I'm blaming that.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
And adding to this and compounding to this was that 1987 was just a few years after Robert Hansen had been arrested for the murder of 14 women in the Anchorage area. So Anchorage was already the people of Anchorage were feeling very unsafe and feeling like their security was definitely at risk.
And just, you know, we will be covering Robert Hansen.
Oh, yeah, that's coming. For sure.
That's on our list of must-dos before the hiatus.
Yes. So the crime that we're going to talk about today just really rocked an already very scared population of people. So let me introduce you to the Newmans. The Newman family consisted of the mom, Nancy, the dad, John, and their two little girls, Melissa, who is just 8 years old, and Angie, who is 3. John had been working as an airline equipment operator, but he had just gotten really injured on the job and was no longer going to be able to continue doing that work, so he had to find a new job to support his family. Workers' comp paid for him to travel to California and take some locksmith and security classes so that he would be able to find a new job that wasn't going to be physically taxing or dangerous. Nancy, at the time, was working as a waitress at a local diner called Gwenny's, which is kind of an Anchorage classic.
It's still there.
It's still there. I asked, my daddy's grown up in Anchorage, if he would consider Gwenny's to be an Anchorage staple. And he says, back in the 70s and 80s, absolutely. But towards the 90s, it sort of transitioned into tourist trap.
Oh. Well, you know, we still eat at tourist traps.
No, yeah.
There's a few places that you just have to go. You have to go to Moose's Tooth. You have to go to Noisy Goose.
And Gwenny's.
And
apparently.
Gwenny's, yes. If you're in Anchorage, yes.
Right. Nancy and John were very much in love, and that was clear to see by anyone who came into contact with them. They were high school sweethearts who got married right after graduation, and their little girls were their entire world. It was just a beautiful, happy little family. The locksmith and security classes that John was taking were going to keep him in California for 3 whole months. He left in late January and was expected back in late March or early April.
Wow. That's mm-hmm. a long time to be apart.
Right.
And she's up here alone in the wintertime. Fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With two little girls.
Two little girls. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the evening of March 13th, Nancy got together with her sister and brother-in-law, who were Cheryl and Paul Chapman.
You said March 13th?
Yes.
So it's about time for him to come home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but he's not home yet.
He's not home yet. Nancy and John were very close with the Chapmans. Nancy had always had a really strong bond with her sister, and Cheryl, even who was the sister, even worked at Gwenny's with Nancy as a hostess. So they were together constantly.
Mm-hmm.
On this particular evening, Nancy, Cheryl, and Paul all went to Gwenny's to get some drinks and dinner and celebrate the upcoming arrival of John, who was going to be back very soon from his California trip. While the adults were all hanging out, Cheryl's teenage daughter took Nancy's younger girls, Melissa and Angie, to the pool to go swimming, which was really nice and gave both couples a little bit of break for the time being, where they could just relax and enjoy each other's company. Nancy spent the evening talking to Cheryl about how excited she was for John to come home, and she told the Chapmans that once he finally got back, she was going to take an entire week off of work to spend some time with him. That was something that was totally unheard of for Nancy. She had an incredibly strong work ethic and was known to never even take a sick day. After the adults finish eating, they decide that they're going to go back to Nancy's house to wait for all of the girls to get back from the pool. Nancy has had a couple of drinks with her dinner, so Cheryl offers to drive her home and says, hey, you can leave your car here at the restaurant, and Paul can pick you up tomorrow to come and get your car if you need him to. So Nancy agrees, and they head off.
So Nancy's car is going to stay at Gwenny's?
Yes.
Okay.
They get to Nancy's house and they put on a pot of coffee and they continue to just chat and hang out until the girls finally get back from their adventures at around 9:30. When the girls get home, it's a little bit after Angie's bedtime, so they all put their coffee mugs in the sink and the Chapmans head home, not knowing that they would never see Nancy or her little girls alive again. Just before 8 a.m. on Sunday morning, which was March 15th of 1987, Paul Chapman was awakened by the phone ringing. When he answers, the person on the other end of the line is from Gwenny's restaurant, so he groggily hands the phone to his wife, Cheryl, thinking that the call is going to be about work. The restaurant employee on the other end of the phone apologizes for waking up the couple and tells Cheryl that Nancy is now 2 hours late for her shift and isn't answering her phone.
She was supposed to work the breakfast on Sunday.
Uh-huh. She also says that Nancy's car is still in the restaurant parking lot from Friday night and asks if Cheryl would feel comfortable going to check on her because this is just so out of character for Nancy.
Oh, so this is Sunday. They had gotten together on Friday.
Correct.
So the car's been there for over a day and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Cheryl and Paul hurriedly get dressed and rush over to Nancy's house immediately, fearing the worst. When they arrive at Nancy's apartment building, Cheryl is shaking too hard to unlock the door, so Paul has to do it.
As they open the front door, they realize that the house is dark and quiet. Cheryl starts having a full-blown panic attack and has to have a seat at the kitchen table, while Paul searches the house for any sign of Nancy or the girls. He doesn't have to look very far to discover their bodies, unmoving and covered in blood, each lying on the floor in the middle of their own bedrooms.
Did the girls share a room?
No. So, they had two separate rooms. Paul goes out to his wife and tells her not to go into the hallway, and he says that all of them are dead. He and Cheryl leave the house, presumably go to a neighbor's, and call 911. On the 911 call, you can hear Cheryl sobbing in the background as Paul tries to explain to the operator what has just happened. I will tell you that I got a lot of information from different sources, but one of the sources I used was this old episode of FBI Files. It was season 1, episode 4, and it's titled Death in Alaska. The whole episode is available free on YouTube, and the link is in the description below. But I will warn you that they do not hold back on the show, and I wasn't quite ready for exactly how the case was going to be presented.
Okay.
They also play a portion of the call, which is very disturbing, so please just watch with care if you do decide to check that one out specifically. When police arrive, the scene that they walk into is difficult for even the most seasoned investigators. This is going to be a pretty brutal description, so trigger warning here. You're going to want to skip ahead at least 5 minutes for this one. Nancy was found in her bedroom, hanging off of her bed, with her nightgown pushed up over her chest and bunched up under her arms. She was splayed out, and there was very obvious injury that was clearly due to a sexual assault. Her face had also been beaten with a blunt object. Her cause of death was very obviously strangulation, because she was found with the blue pillowcase that had killed her still wrapped around her neck. Angie, the 3-year-old, was found in her own room, in the middle of the floor, naked. Her throat had been slit so deeply that she had nearly been decapitated. She was covered head to toe in her own blood, except for a single stripe that had been wiped clean from her chest to her pelvis, as though the killer had wiped that area with a washcloth.
That's weird.
Yeah. She also had a deep cut to one of her hands, which indicated that she tried to protect herself from her attacker, yes. 8-year-old Melissa was found in the middle of the floor in her room. Her nightgown was pushed up over her chest, and her underwear were wadded up just a few feet away from her body. She had very obvious trauma and a substantial amount of blood in her pelvic area from a vicious sexual assault. The blood trail in the house showed that her attacker had brought her into her mother's room and assaulted her there, then took her back to her own room where he assaulted her again before she was strangled to death with a pillowcase. Melissa's hands were also bound with a different pillowcase. It is thought that Nancy was forced to watch the assault on Melissa before she was raped and murdered herself. All of the bodies were posed in very exposing positions. The evidence collection from the house took days. Each room had to be treated as its own separate crime scene. In Nancy's room, there were green gloves found that had strands of Nancy's hair on them. It is thought that the killer put these on while murdering Nancy, but for some reason took them off before he left the master bedroom. In the bathroom sink, they found a rag that had pubic hair, semen, and blood all over it. There was semen in or on all three of the bodies, but in 1987, there wasn't a whole lot that they could do with that. There was some blood that wasn't from the Newmans that was found, but again, all they could do in 1987 was some very basic blood typing. There were also pubic hairs found in Nancy's bed, on her body. There was one pubic hair found on Angie's body, the 3-year-old, and 3 more that were found in the carpet around her body. There were 13 pubic hairs found on Melissa's body and more in her bed and on her carpet. This comes into play later. Most of the pubic hairs that were found were bloodied. Over 100 fingerprints were found that did not belong to the Newman family and were consistent with one person. Those prints were found on the inside and outside of the front door, the inside and outside of Nancy's bedroom door, and there was a perfect bloody palm print on the wall just 10 inches above the bed in Melissa's room where she had been attacked.
which to me kind of says he put his hand up on the wall to brace himself.
Yeah. Yep. That's the thought. Yep. There was a cookie tin sitting empty on the kitchen table that Nancy always used to put her tips in at the end of the day. It was one of those blue English cookie tins that every grandma has and uses for sewing supplies.
I was going to say it was a button box, wasn't it?
Always. So that's what she kept her tip in. But like I said, almost all of Nancy's tips were in coins. So she would usually have quite a collection of coins in there that she would then roll and use to pay for meals or put in her account, whatever. The tip tin was empty when the police got there, and it is thought that the killer stole her tip money. And they found fingerprints on that tip tin. Also missing from the house was the family camera, Nancy's purse, and a chef's knife from the kitchen, which was thought to be the murder weapon for little Angie, and the way that the killer had subdued three victims on his own.
And forced a mother to watch.
Yep.
Yeah. Can't imagine. Cannot imagine.
The coffee mugs from Friday night were the only dishes that were in the sink, and there was a bowl of cereal on the kitchen table. In the ashtray, there was a little cluster of cigarette butts. Only one of them had a yellow butt, meaning that it was not the brand that Nancy or the Chapmans smoked. And remember that the Chapmans got to the apartment on Sunday morning, and Paul had unlocked the front door, so whoever had done this had to have a key, or else he wouldn't have been able to lock the door behind him. There were no signs of forced entry, and the house was not ransacked. The killer knew exactly where to find the things that he wanted to take, like the purse and the camera.
Mom was wearing her pajamas.
So Melissa was too.
Yeah. So do they think it was on Saturday night or Friday night or Saturday night?
At this point in the investigation, they think that it is Friday night that this happened.
Or early Saturday morning, because their Chapmans were there.
Yeah. They're thinking it was like after everybody went to bed on Friday night, like in the middle of the night, was the thinking. John flew back to Anchorage the moment that he found out what happened. I don't think there are any words that exist that could accurately describe what he must have been going through at the time. He got home and started making burial preparations for his whole family. He then got an oversized coffin and he buried his wife with one of his children under each of her arms, so that even in death, she could be protecting and watching over them. Which is making me tear up a little bit right now. The police were put under a lot of pressure to find this guy and put him away very quickly. The community was scared that this was someone who was breaking into random houses to commit these heinous acts, and they were still reeling from the crimes of Robert Hansen just a few years earlier. So there was a lot of fear, and this family was about as low risk as you could get. So there was a feeling that no one is safe. A task force was created, and all of the residents in the Newman's apartment complex were interviewed, as well as the families, friends, acquaintances, and coworkers. For a time, it was speculated that maybe John was the killer, because the husband is always the first suspect. And it was thought that maybe he had somehow traveled to Anchorage and back to California just to commit the crimes and make it look like he had an alibi. But of course, there was no evidence found that supported that theory, and he was dropped as a suspect very early on.
Well, there's fingerprints, too.
Right. The police also looked at Paul Chapman for a time, but he, too, was ruled out very quickly for a lack of motive and a pretty strong alibi. I mean, his whole family could vouch that he had gone home that night.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many times have we found that it's either the person who last saw them alive or the person that discovers the body? Oh, wait, he's both.
I would agree with that, but in this case, that's
I'm just saying, I see where the police were coming from. Mm-hmm. And they would have been remiss in not thinking it was him for a minute.
Right. In an effort to get a better idea of who exactly they were looking for, the police brought in the FBI's behavioral analysis unit to try and get a profile on the personality of their killer. The profile that was composed said that the perpetrator they were looking for was going to be a white man in his early 20s who knew the Newmans well. It was also suggested that their perp might have a history of sexual violence towards women or girls, and that he might not fit well into society. In light of the profile, police start to compile a list of recently released convicts who had been convicted of sex crimes. And to that list, they added a couple of names that kept coming up during the interviews. One of the names was of a neighbor who had just moved into the Newman's apartment complex and fit the profile pretty well. And the other was a relative of the family. This new list that had all those names on it becomes their prime suspect list, and the police began to whittle down one by one, checking alibis and searching for potential motives. Eventually, their list goes from hundreds of names down to six names, down to two names. The last people left standing are the neighbor and the relative.
The two names that they just added to the list.
Yes. After a while, the neighbor is also ruled out because even though he had moved into the same apartment as the Newmans, it was finally confirmed that he had never actually met them.
Complex, not apartment.
The same apartment complex as the Newmans. It was finally confirmed that he had never met them after all, so it was unlikely that he would have had the rage against them that was necessary to commit such acts of violence. And that left one name, John Newman's nephew, 23-year-old Kirby Anthony. Kirby definitely fit the demographics of the profile. He was a young white man, a bit of a loner. He had problems with the law, mainly robbery and assault, what came up on his record when they looked him up. There were also several family members who mentioned some tension between Kirby and the Newmans. Kirby had lived in Idaho for most of his life, but he moved to Anchorage with his girlfriend about 18 months before the murders, which would have been in October of 1985. With nowhere to really go and not enough money to rent his own place, Kirby asked his Uncle John if he and his girlfriend could stay with them for a little while until they got back on their feet. The Newmans agreed, and for a while, everything was okay, but it was never really great. Kirby didn't get along well with the kids in the house, and his frequent drug use and bad habits would make Nancy and John pretty wary. Luckily, Kirby and his girlfriend would find work pretty quickly on a local fishing boat, so they would no longer need to stay with John and Nancy because these fishing boats are a live-in position. Kirby and his girlfriend would spend the next year or so living on the fishing boat, but things didn't go great for him there either. Because he was constantly beating his girlfriend and eventually accused her of sleeping with the boat's skipper.
Of course he did.
The situation escalated to a point where Kirby was fired and thrown off the crew.
But the girlfriend wasn't?
No, apparently they definitely took her side. Again, with nowhere to go, he turned back to John and Nancy Newman. He would move back into the Newman house on Valentine's Day of 1987. By this point, John was already in California, so it was just Kirby, Nancy, and the two little girls. This time around, things were definitely a lot more rocky.
Well, there wasn't John there to run interference, too.
Right. Nancy would call John in late February and tell him that Kirby had been making some inappropriate comments to her and making her feel uncomfortable.
Yeez out.
He also apparently was not treating the daughters well in an... On at least one occasion, he had hit Melissa in anger. On March 4th, just 10 days before the murders, Kirby's parents came to the Newman house for a visit. Kirby's dad made a belittling comment about Kirby, which then escalated into a physical fight. At one point, Kirby screamed at his dad and said, quote, "All I ever wanted was for you to love and respect me, and you never would," end quote. Kirby's mom at one point also told Nancy that Kirby might be suicidal and that was really the last straw for Nancy. She couldn't have that kind of behavior around her kids, so she kicked Kirby out. According to Kirby's friends and the new roommate that he would then move in with, Kirby did not take the shunning lightly. It pissed him off pretty bad. So he's looking like a pretty good suspect to police.
And now we also have the problem is that he lived in that house, so his DNA,
yeah,
his fingerprints,
mm-hmm,
possibly his semen, should be there. There are places it should not be.
Right. Yeah.
Well, DNA isn't an issue at this point in time, but his blood, his semen, and his hair and fingerprints that we know can be linked directly to him.
Right.
There's places they should not be, like 10 inches above the bed.
Right. And bloody fingerprints. Like, it wasn't just regular fingerprints. They were bloody fingerprints. Try explaining that one. When the police asked him what he had been doing on Friday night, he said that he had spent the entire night at a party. He had been drinking and smoking. He smoked some weed. He did some cocaine. There were tons of people who all verified this alibi, so police took a step back for a little bit. But then the autopsy reports came back, and the police learned that the Newman girls were killed on Saturday morning, not on Friday night like they had thought.
So maybe when they were getting up and moving on Saturday?
Yes.
So Nancy didn't work on Saturday, so nobody was missed. So maybe they were up and getting moving on Saturday morning.
Right. Which would explain the bowl of cereal that they found on the kitchen table.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, Kirby's airtight alibi has some pretty major holes in it.
Yeah, because he's not alibied for Saturday. He's alibied for Friday night.
When they go back to ask him about the new timeline, he said that he was at a local Burger King until 7 a.m., and then he went to his buddy's house at 8:30 a.m. and stayed there all morning. The problem is that the buddy that Kirby said he had gone and seen said that Kirby didn't get there until 10:30 a.m., which was thought to be after the Newmans were already dead, and that left him wide open to have committed the crime. So the police start trying to make Kirby sweat a little bit. They put surveillance on him for a while, and then they back off. And then they start surveilling him again, and then they back off. And then they bring him in for questioning again, and this time they ask him for a hair and a blood sample. Kirby, not wanting to appear guilty, complied. Besides, he was living at the house until 10 days before the murder, right? So his hair and DNA should have been all over the place anyway, right? Wrong.
Not in the places they found it.
No. The crime lab that was processing the evidence at the scene knew that they were going to have to prove that the pubic hairs, especially, that were on the bodies couldn't have just been left there from the time that Kirby had been living in the house. Now, the crime techs had a lot of ways that they could prove this. Firstly, a bunch of hair that was found at the scene had fresh blood on it that was the victim's, or had been found on or inside the victim's body. So it's really hard to have that happen by accidental transfer. Second, they knew that Nancy had vacuumed her house on Friday, March 13th, because she had to borrow Cheryl and Paul's vacuum to do so. In the vacuum that was at the house, that was Cheryl and Paul's vacuum, there was one single hair that was found in the vacuum bag that was consistent with Kirby's. The crime scene techs picked a total of at least 24 pubic hairs alone from the house, from their vacuuming. So it stands to reason that the 24 hairs had to have been deposited after the vacuum was ran on Friday. Either that, or maybe it had to have been a really shitty vacuum.
I was just going to say, Cheryl, you need a new vacuum.
Right.
It's not doing nothing.
But, I mean, in all likelihood, the simplest explanation is that it was there after. There was also another little gross fact that showed that the hair was recent. You see, after a hair is shed, it's usually pretty clean and intact. But as time goes on, not only does dirt start to cling to the hair, but also little microscopic beetles will munch on the hair, leaving little bite marks on the hair shaft. This is a common thing. It happens all the time. The internal structure of the hair will also start to break down over time, making it pretty clear to distinguish old shed hair from newly dropped hair. The hair that was collected from the crime scene was free of dust and debris. It had no bite marks on it from these tiny, and it had no bite marks on it from these tiny beetles, suggesting that it had been shed within a few days of being, at most, of being collected. Now, hair analysis has had some eyebrows raised in terms of being a reliable forensic science. But there was one...
Without DNA testing, yes.
Right. But there was one other really gross little detail that made it very hard to prove that the pubic hairs at the crime scene had come from anyone other than Kirby. You see, Kirby had pubic lice at the time of the murders. So all of those little pubic hairs that had been found had little egg cases on them from the pubic lice. So the likelihood that those came from anyone else goes way down. I mean, he wasn't the only person to have pubic lice at the time in Anchorage, probably. He got it from
somewhere
and he
gives it to someone. But here's the other thing. If they're in the egg, you know, the little egg capsules, like lice have those little, they look like sand. They would have either hatched or died in 10 days. So hard to say that they were there before, you know, when he lived there.
Right.
The eggs haven't hatched or died.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, it couldn't have been anyone else's hair but Kirby's, because he's the one who has the alibi. He's the one who has...
Right, I get that, but it's also... I mean, also,
no alibi and no motive.
But it also puts a timeline on him, too, that they weren't there for 10 days.
I mean, he could have been infected with them 10 days prior still and just not gotten them treated until then.
What I'm saying is the hair wouldn't have been left on the floor for 10 days without the egg hatching or without...
Well, they found the egg, like, cases. Like, it... There was one lab tech who also kind of went above and beyond to prove that these hairs had also likely not just been transferred from one room to another by regular walking and movement. He decided that he was going to take a crime scene vacuum to his house to try and see how many pubic hairs would travel from his room to other rooms of the house. He was trying to do this to just make sure that Kirby couldn't get on the stand and say that, oh, well,
I shaved, those just got there. Yeah,
On my socks. Like, that didn't...
And there was a pile.
That doesn't prove that I raped them.
To the whole house.
Yeah. So the crime scene tech was like, I could see that it might be a defense, so I'm going to disprove it and see how my pubic hair travels over the course of 2 weeks. So what he did is every single day for 2 weeks, he vacuumed his house with the crime scene vacuum. And he did it, like, after each room, he would empty the bag so he could tell, like, where the pubic hairs had been collected, which room the pubic hairs had been collected from. And he just wanted to see, like, how far they could travel. His little experiment found that it was not very easy for these hairs to move from one room to another. And it almost always happened on the bottom of people's socks or shoes. But there was no way that he could find that that kind of transfer could have been responsible for the pubic hairs being found on each of the bodies in the Newman house. He said, it's just, it wouldn't have happened like that. So his little experiment was used in court eventually. So that was great. Now, not only do they have the hair that matches, but also, of course, those 100 fingerprints that they found matched to Kirby. His blood type was also consistent with that mystery blood that was found at the scene. Every time the police interviewed Kirby, they also noticed that there would be details of his alibi.
I mean, his story would change?
And his story of what he did that night, which would change each time they asked. So he's not really being fully upfront with them either. The police decided to look into his past a little bit, and they find that this is not the first time that Kirby has been connected to a case like this.
What?
While Kirby was living in Idaho, he was the prime suspect in the rape of a 12-year-old girl. She had been at the park, hanging out with her friends, when she was lured away into the woods by a man. The man then brutally raped her and strangled her to the point of causing permanent brain damage and blindness in one eye and hearing loss in one of her ears. Kirby was pretty much the police's only suspect in that case, but the victim was unable to positively identify Kirby because of the extent of her injuries, so he was never arrested for that crime.
Wow.
So now police are feeling pretty good, and they're about to arrest him when they get a call from the roommate that he had been staying with. And the roommate says, hey guys, so Kirby just had it out, and he told me that he was going to Canada. He left 7 hours ago. I just thought I should let you know.
So 7 hours, he could be almost Canada.
The amount of time it would have taken him to get to Toke was 8 hours.
Yep.
And Toke is where the border crossing is.
Well, it's about an hour and a half out of Toke, but still.
Mm-hmm. Right. Toke so he would have gotten to Toke mm-hmm. by this point.
The roommate, and the troopers would have had to get up there.
Yeah. So the roommate said that he would have told the police sooner, but that he was kind of intimidated by Kirby and didn't want to get on his bad side. So he was like, I'll give him quite a head start before I let the police know.
He did that.
By the time the roommate called the police, Kirby had been on the road for 7 hours already. Like I said, it only takes 8 hours total to get from Anchorage to the Canada border crossing in Toke, which is where he was headed. Luckily, though, they didn't need to catch up with him. They just needed to call the border crossing guards and let them in on the situation so that they could stop him when he tried to cross. It was about midnight when Kirby eventually rolled up to the border crossing outside of Toke, and just as planned, the border agents stopped him and were able to hold him for driving on a suspended license until troopers could get the arrest warrant in place and formally arrest him for his role in the murders of Nancy, Melissa, and Angie Newman. The final charges put on him were, of course, 3 counts of aggravated first-degree murder. 1 count of rape, 1 count of sexual abuse against a child under the age of 13, and 1 count of kidnapping because Melissa's hands had been tied, which qualified that as a kidnapping case. When the police finally searched Kirby's house, they found the Newman family camera. Nancy's purse and the knife that had been used to murder Angie was never found, even to this day. Kirby tried to explain away the camera by saying that John had let him borrow it before he had left for California. But when he was asked to demonstrate how the camera worked, he had no idea how to use it. So it seems a little bit like an unlikely explanation.
Did he have a bunch of rolled coin?
Police also found a number of people who had either seen Kirby rolling large amounts of coins or paying for small things with rolled coins, which very well could have come from Nancy's tip tin. When the trial came around, Kirby pled not guilty. He tried to act as his own co-counsel in his defense, which was torture for the Newman surviving family members.
Was he questioning the family?
Yes. So especially John, Cheryl, and Paul, who all had to testify. When John Newman had to take the stand, he burst into hysterical sobs when the first question was asked.
I can't imagine.
They were able to take a little break where John was able to compose himself and was eventually able to give his full testimony. But I cannot fathom what he must have been going through. During the trial, John Newman found comfort and solace from kind of an unlikely source. Do you remember the Faccio family murders that we talked about several episodes on the podcast? It was earlier on.
Yes.
The murder of the older couple and the sister of the older couple.
In their nice home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By
people who are jealous.
Like a 13-year-old. Yeah. I don't think it was a 14-year-old.
14 something and like her that. Older boyfriend. Yes. Right. Okay, I remember that.
So
Do you want an episode number?
Sure. It was episode 11. So the daughter of the Faccio couple is still alive to this day. She's actually not too different in age than John. And she had just gotten through the trials and everything that happened with her family, the daughter did. And she went to every single day of the Newman trial and provided comfort to John because she was pretty much the only person in the entire world who could understand some semblance of what he might have been going through.
Right. That's pretty amazing that she's that strong.
Yeah, she had heard about the case through the news and everything, and she just genuinely wanted to help because she remembered how isolated and alone she felt.
And nobody understood. And
yeah, so she went and she ended up being a great support person for John throughout the trial. On the day that John broke down in court and had to leave, she met up with him and she took him to the shooting range and she let him fire off a bunch of guns. And he said that both of them said that that had helped substantially. It helped a lot. He just needed to, like, get that out. And the shooting range was a place where he could do that safely.
And I put a picture of the asshole on the target.
The police really raised their eyes when they heard about that.
Oh, did he really do that?
He really?
Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Oh, he just went to the shooting range.
He just went to the shooting range. Mm-hmm. And when the police are like, you did what? I don't know if you should have guns right now. But anyway, it was a really beneficial thing for John. It helped him a lot. And he was able to testify later on and finish out his testimony, which helped him considerably. So that was a really cool thing and definitely connected another case that we've already covered. Right. So that was very interesting. Kirby tried to go with the defense that the police had tunnel vision and were entirely framing him for this crime. He had no explanation for the hairs that had been found or the washcloth or really anything. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor was able to come up with a number of witnesses who had seen Kirby in the weeks after the murder and before his arrest. Several of the witnesses had stories of Kirby telling them details about the crime that had not been released to the public. He told one of his friends at Chilkoot Charlie's that the worst part of the crime was that Nancy had been forced to watch the death of her daughter. That detail was not released to the public until the trial. So there was no way he could have known that unless he knew something about it. He also told details to his own mother that had not been released as well. The same night that he was at Chilkoot Charlie's, he had been writing down these little poems on cocktail napkins at the bar and passing them around to anyone who would take them. And they were a little ominous in light of everything that he was charged with, but nothing that was outright incriminating. Right. I have one of them that he wrote.
Somebody kept it?
Yeah. Okay. It was evidence of the trial.
Well, I know that, but somebody kept it long enough for it to be evidence.
Yeah, I know. Okay, kind of gross. It say? Subjecting to his wild assault, losing all the mind's reason, captured in an addictive vault, twisting life's dimensions. Which isn't even a perfect rhyme, so I hate him. I hate him for every other reason except for that, but it's another reason. Just add it to the pile. So, just creepy, just ominous, creepy. You know? Mm-hmm. I met with a bookstore owner in Talkeetna, and I was actually buying one of the books that I used to research this case. The bookstore owner had actually met Kirby Anthony in the time between the crimes and the time that he was arrested. And she said she didn't have any real strong interactions about him, interactions with him. I mean, it was just kind of a passing thing. She had served him at a restaurant. She, of course, didn't know what he had done at the time because he hadn't been arrested for it. But after he was arrested, she was like, I remember that guy because he gave off the worst of vibes. Hmm. She said that his eyes were just dark and cold and that there was just nothing there. So he wasn't the most warm or welcoming of souls, for sure. John Newman went to every single day of that trial that he was allowed to go. There were a few days that he couldn't go because he was testifying. But any day that he could be there, he was there. At one point, after all the testimony had been read and before the jury was dismissed to deliberate, Kirby turned around to the gallery and he looked at John. Kirby looked at John and he said, "You're a fool, John." And then he waited for a bit. And he said, "I love you with all my heart," end quote. John Newman blew up. He said, "Don't you talk to me." And he shouted at him and he said, "You don't you even talk to me." So
he's lucky that's all he did.
Right. He had other people in the courtroom were physically holding him back. Which, I mean, you'd have to. The jury convicted Kirby on all counts, and he was sentenced to 357 years for his crimes. Because of the just horrific nature of the crime, there was a huge push around the time of the trial to reinstate the death penalty in Alaska just so that this guy could be put to death. There were people who were writing to the justice system and saying, I will flip the switch for free. Like, please.
Well, Robert Hansen was just in prison, too.
Yeah. During his time in prison, he was attacked pretty early on.
He's a child rapist.
He survived. He was fine, but he was attacked by another inmate who was in a gang and was involved in some violence. And he just said, like, I have a daughter, and if I see him again, like, he won't make it out. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, he's still alive. He's living in Spring Creek Correctional Facility. There have been some fights over the years. I think the most recent one was, like, 2008. So it's been a while. But he's not getting out ever. Ever, ever, ever. He's not eligible for parole until 100 years from now, I think, actually. It was 2224 or something like that. Hmm. So he's not going to ever see the light of day again, which is good. He appealed at one point. He was asking, he said he had ineffective counsel, and then that was completely dismissed because he represented himself. And then he said that...
And when they allow people to do that, they have to... The judges are not dumb because they know that that's going to be the appeal.
Yeah.
So they make sure that he's co-counsel. He has people to talk to help him, advise him. He's not up there by himself learning the law. Yeah.
And during the trial, he had tried to take the stand in his own defense. That did not go well, as you can imagine. I mean, it just made him look way worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, 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 very rare that a defendant will come off the stand after, like, trying to defend themselves looking better than before they got on the stand. And that did not happen here. He looked terrible after he was on the stand. The entire time during the trial, he had just this cocky attitude the entire time until the verdict came back, and then he started crying.
Mm-hmm.
It really upset me to know that, like, to see the video of him crying when the verdict was read, because there are reports, like police reports, from when he was told about the deaths of the Newmans, and he, like, buried his face in his hands and started screaming, but there were no tears. Oh. So that was really upsetting.
He'll never be charged.
The whole case is really upsetting.
He'll never be charged in the Idaho case.
No, he can't be.
I'm guessing a statute of limitations once DNA came around from this poor girl who was assaulted.
Right. If they even collected DNA from that assault.
And he's in prison for life, forever and ever. So why go through that expense? Because they're not going to expedite him to Idaho or whatever. And have him charged there for a lesser crime than what he'd serve up here.
Right. There was another appeal.
Although the poor girl might have some sense of justice.
Right, justice.
Well, I would think that her family at least knows that. pretty sure this guy did it, you know.
Right. There was another appeal that Kirby wanted while he was in prison. And he wanted the DNA to be tested from the Newman case. And the judge was basically like, why would we do that? Like, there's so much evidence here that you're guilty and you've already been convicted. The DNA is not going to exonerate you, and we're not going to spend the taxpayers' money to do that. So he got denied for that one. This case is gross and I hate it. And I'm glad it's over. Any other parting thoughts, Mom?
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
He was their cousin.
Yeah. Really gross. It's so upsetting. So, we hope you enjoyed the way that we told this case, ? We hope you keep listening, and we hope that you guys all have a safe and happy holiday season. Thanksgiving, all of the above. For us, Thanksgiving hasn't happened yet, but I know that by the time this releases, we'll be on our way to Christmas by now.
Cyber Monday!
Right. So, just stay safe, hold your children close, and don't forget to take your vitamin D.
Bye.
Bye.